Good evening, and welcome to the Commonwealth Club's InForum Connect Your Intellect. My name is Martine Paris, and I'm the Electronic Arts Online Marketing Manager for the epic action fantasy role-playing game Kingdoms of Amalur: Reckoning. Have to get a plug-in on that one. And the producer of tonight's event, Obsessive Lust and Longing on Facebook, featuring the musings of digital media icon Zay Frank. So rather than reading his bio full of lifetime accolades, Zay asked me to introduce him in a way that's meaningful to me. So I'll tell you. I first met Zay at VidCon last summer at a fan fest of YouTube stars celebrating the democratization of video expression. And afterwards, I spoke with him a little bit about the growing importance of Facebook as a platform where soon a billion people will be spending most of their time and much of their money. But what blew me away was Zay's observation of the drivers behind the addictive behavior that is the phenomena of social media. And then I knew I had to bring him to the Commonwealth Club because he has a fantastic presentation to share with you. So please join me in welcoming Zay Frank.
Thank you so much. Hi. How are you guys? Really? Do you speak for everyone?
How about you?
I'm doing okay. Yeah, this is totally different than I thought this was going to be like. It's like a conversation. Let's not do these slides. There's people listening on the radio. So I might pause and like say what's on the slide once in a while. Like, this is the world's largest dog riding on top of the world's smallest cat. For anyone out there listening. Listen. So first of all, it's a huge honor to be here at the Commonwealth Club. This is like everybody's spoken here. Some of my greatest heroes and some of the people that I don't like as much have all spoken here, and it's been absolutely incredible. Like Martin Luther King spoke here, and Nancy Pelosi, and just incredible. I mean, up to this point, I think my greatest moment was walking into a restroom in a club in Miami right after Michael Jordan. You know, that was like cool. And this is cooler so far. It says the Commonwealth Club on the screen. Just in way of introduction to this, last week I received this email. The Commonwealth Club needs to postpone your 5-2 program. The last time I was provided numbers for your program, the attendance wasn't high enough to warrant your flight to SF. So I've been thinking a lot about all of you, and it's really nice to see you in the flesh because I have to say that for when I got this email, I was really, really sad. And I started in my mind thinking about what you had done when you saw the announcement and decided not to come. Maybe it was Pilates or, you had to walk your dog, but you don't even own a dog. I know that. And I even started looking up at the competition. This is, going on simultaneously. And it was like a world without fish was better than a Monday without me. And it was awful. I even went further. He's bringing his daughter on stage, and I started imagining what my imaginary daughter might have done on stage to make my talk kind of better. And she's fluent in like 6 languages. She would have opened with hello in 6 languages. That's how cool it would have been. But then I got this email. Many apologies. The email below was based on a complete miscommunication. It's actually the complete opposite of what I was told. Now, in this moment, I went from loathing you because I felt like you loathed me. I felt like you were like, this guy's such a... I felt like you were looking through my soul and thinking, what a weak, pathetic person this is, that he could possibly come to San Francisco and speak to us about anything. And it's fairly incredible because this turn with all of you that are now here with glowing teeth and wonderful skin, is the basis of my virtual life and what I've experienced over the last 10 years. And I think what is the basis of your virtual life and what you experience on a day-to-day basis, just as a way of telling you a little bit about the story of myself. 10 years ago, actually, this year, I released this, which was called How to Dance Properly. And it was an invitation to my 29th birthday party. And it went viral. Right, I just sent it out to 17 people the following Monday. A million people had come to this site, and it kept growing. And it was absolutely insane. My father learned about this site from a colleague in Argentina before I had a chance to tell him about it. And it was this wild thing because, you know, the way that I interacted with this audience was statistics, right? It was these bars that got larger all of a sudden. And if I could get some water at some point, that would be wonderful. These bars got larger, right? And this was the point of contact with this hidden audience. And it was this as well, right? This was my email was downloading faster than it could. You know, there were more emails in queue than it could download, and they all said the same thing. Hi, 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 hi. And also, you know, you have a lot of time on your hands, which at that time was totally true. I had a lot of time on my hands. But it was this incredible sort of promise, and this was in 2001, and there was, thank you, there was this promise of connection. Right, in these virtual spaces. And what strikes me about this was how minuscule the point of contact that I had, but was, you know, resulted in this overwhelming feeling of potential and hope and promise to connect. It really, this is the crux of craving popularity, is that it's craving something. It's not just craving popularity for popularity's sake. It's craving acceptance, right? Some sort of a feeling of union. And so what I did from that point on was started to copy myself and do whatever I possibly could to get that kind of acceptance. Again, this one, my cat Annie, right? They're all copies of the original. You know, when you use your pets in design, you've run out of ideas. And so I had to jump over to different things. This was an interactive puppet that you could play with. I'm turning the gravity down to negative 10. This is a frog that speaks when you do. This is something called the Scribbler that I started teaching myself how to code, and I was interested in facilitating people who didn't know how to draw so that they could feel a little bit more creative. And so this turns everything that you do into post-war German etchings. And these were all images created by very, very young people using that tool. It is incredibly satisfying. I'm sorry I'm moving fast. I have like 140 slides and 40 minutes. This, by the way, a lot of people ended up drawing very inappropriate drawings with my online drawing tools. So I created this, which was my passive aggressive way of dealing with them. Anything that you draw, it just morphs it into a particular shape. And my apologies to the Commonwealth Club. I bet that's the first time that that's happened here. But the thing here is that these sorts of experiences that I had with my audience, right? I mean, you have to think that this was all started with this desire to connect. And this is the great promise of the connected web, is that we can connect to people. This period of my life reminds me of this sign, right? This is the crossing sign in the streets of Amsterdam. And what always amazes me about this sign is that it just seems like he's really just intent on pressing that button. It doesn't seem like he really wants to do anything else. Crossing the street is secondary for him. I could see him getting up and putting on his nicely tailored suit, by the look of it, going down to the corner and just pressing this button over and over again. But something is happening in that picture. You know that, right? And it's very, very similar to what's happening in this picture. Something is happening there. Life is happening there. but it's incredibly difficult to figure out what life that is. I always imagine her getting a text saying, imagine that you're on a street corner. And I think about what a wonderful street corner that must be in her mind, right? There's this sense that there's a whole universe contained in that image. And it leads me to, you know, this concept. And there's a wonderful book by Tor Norotranders called The User Illusion. And he's dealing with what consciousness is and why it came about. And he has this term in it, which I came across, called exformation. And it turns out when, you know, you're in an environment where communicating information is incredibly important and we have limited amounts of space and capacity to communicate that information, right? This is bandwidth in the general term. What becomes more important than the information is actually the information that you throw away in order to condense the information. A good example of that would be this, if you got this as a text. Do you know what today is? Now, this could scare the crap out of you if you were in a relationship, right? Because you would be incredibly aware of all the information that has been cast away to come to this moment, right? Even more, if somebody texts you something like this, okay, that's fine. I mean, this can be a terribly damaging, awful text or quite a wonderful text, depending on the context of it. And it keeps going down the chain, right? Really? ? Can be awful. Absolutely awful to receive or just wonderful, part of a conversation. By the time that you get to these two pieces of punctuation, the entire world can be hidden inside of that, of this moment. So, what do we do? We start loading ourselves up with exclamation marks and kisses to make sure that the information goes through appropriately, right? And what all this points to is the fact that in these virtualized environments that we live in, right, when we're standing on a street corner that's robust with information and we get a text about, well, imagine if you were standing on a street corner, we have to unpack all that information that's in that 140 characters, that's in that two pieces of punctuation. And how do we do it? If we don't have the proper context to unpack the information, if we don't know what it means, we fill it. We fill it with our own imaginations, right? We fill it with our own minds. And this is the problem of Facebook profile images, right? We see one little gesture, one thing, and we fill out an entire personality around this. We're like, oh my gosh, she must be wonderful at parties. She must saunter in and give that gesture over the side of it. And every other moment must be as beautiful, as stunning, right? And the same thing with text. I'm now talking about somebody who is very optimistic, but of course somebody who's very anxious like me and pessimistic immediately goes to the worst possible scenario, right? And this is one of the amazing things. It's why music and lyrics are so wonderful, right? It's when all that information and context is stripped away, it feels like it is speaking directly to us, right? Desperado. Man, it's my song, right? Because I've unpacked every moment in that song to think of myself in a bus. I, for some reason, a VW bus comes to mind, but probably different for you. It might be a Harley. But there's an interesting part of this, because I think with a lot of us, there is an intensity to virtual spaces, right? When we go online, when we go to certain places, we have this feeling of intensity, of a certain kind of intensity that's almost missing from other spaces, which keeps us in these spaces, which keeps us addicted and hooked in some kind of a way. And that's because we're unpacking them with these things that are inside of us, these virtual experiences. But what I found in this time when I was playing around and making a lot of different things was that there was a little bit of a struggle for me, because when you're doing so much unpacking in your own mind, when you're filling all the gaps, you're not really connecting with anyone, right? There's a little bit of a wall there. You can have the feeling of connection sometimes, but it ultimately is your universe that you're in. So I came across this. This was a term that I was first introduced to by my psychologist, who I spend a lot of time with. So he introduces me to a lot of words I don't know. It's puer eternus, right? And it's the eternal child. I think it's actually the eternal boy. There's another term for the eternal girl. And what it is, it's a Jungian archetype, right? And this is a wonderful book by Marie-Louise Franz, who I'll talk about a little bit later. But it's really based on the myth of Dionysus. And now Dionysus would have totally, like, kicked butt in the Craigslist personals in San Francisco. This guy was, like, awesome in the kind of way that a lot of people think awesome is defined. The god of mischief and grapes and just like partying constantly and ecstasy, just absolutely like a spring of human life. Now, there are a lot of puers that have dominated the news. For example, I think the most famous would be Michael Jackson. This is a portrait that he had painted of himself. This is, you know, this notion of the eternal youth, of youth springing forward for eternity. And obviously with Michael Jackson, there was a certain perversity to it, but there was also a certain charm which endeared almost everyone to him in to one degree or another. Peter Pan is another one. A lot of people miss the reference to Pan in the name, right? Which is another one of these sort of gods, these child gods, these eternal child gods. In the early adaptations of the work for stage, the Peter Pan used to come out on stage with a goat, and he had horns, right? Totally different variation. But you can see it's the same kind of thing, this youthfulness, this thing moving forward. So here are some of the descriptions that Marie-Louise Franz writes about the puer eternus, which absolutely struck me, right? The charm of youth and the stirring quality of a drink of champagne, a secret thought that one day one will be able to save the world, a rich inner fantasy life, difficulty to conforming to the world of the adult. Now, keep in mind that my therapist was referring to me at this point, and he was sure that this would help me in some way. But I have to say that a lot of these things also apply to the web, just in general, and keep that in mind moving forward. Now, I absolutely agree with all these things. I have had fantasies of saving the world. I am certainly prone to that. I have the David and Goliath kind of fantasy quite a bit. And so this stuff actually did resonate with me. And I will say that it's always what has disturbed me about 1 Corinthians. It's beautiful, right? This is like one of the most celebrated pieces of text in the Bible. And it's read at weddings, and love is patient. It's this gorgeous, gorgeous thing. But then you get to this 13:11. When I was a child, I talked like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child, but then I became an adult and I set aside childish ways. Like, what a bummer. You know, it's like, I feel like the poet was sitting down, like, on the computer typing the good part, and then somebody just came in, like, when he went to the bathroom and was like, oh, by the way, you know, it's all gonna suck, right? I joke about it, but it's true. I have this sense of, like, well, where are the instructions? If it was so darn important, tell me how to be an adult, because I don't really know. Now, Marie-Louise Franz, she talks about a particular puer eternus when she kind of like develops her theory around this. And in her case, it's the writer, the author of The Little Prince, Exupéry. And the, do you like how I said that? I totally practiced that. Exupéry. The interesting thing is that he, in the classic sort of definition, in the Jungian terms, embodies every part of the puer, and not only does he embody it, but his works embody it, like purely, wonderfully. A man who is incapable of letting go of youth, So in hers, you know, she there's how many of you have read this wonderful, sad little story? I encourage the rest of you to read it. It resonates incredibly with some people, puers, and is sort of a tragic, awful story to the rest of society. But so there's one point where the little prince asks Exupéry to draw him sheep. And he draws these sheep, and he says, "No, this one's too frail. No, that one's too old. This was the one that's too old." And then finally, Exupéry gets exasperated and just draws a box and says, "It's in there." And the little prince says, "Wonderful. Beautiful. That's exactly what I wanted." It's kind of like what I was talking about before, right? It's sort of the iPhone. It's the same thing. It's the craving for a virtual experience that satisfies our deepest needs because they are our deepest needs. Forget about the reality of the situation. It's wanting that thing. There's also another amazing little set of drawings inside The Little Prince where Exupéry, who's a pilot in this particular thing, it is autobiographical to some extent, he has this test because he hates adults. And this is a grown man speaking. He hates adults, and so he gives them a test. And he draws this picture, and he's been doing it since he was a child. He draws this picture, and he says, "Do you like this picture?" And adults say, "No, it's a bad drawing of a hat." And he walks away. He walks away. Adults don't get it. When the little prince sees this, the little prince immediately says, "No, I don't want a picture of a snake that just swallowed an elephant." And Exupéry is like in this moment of ecstasy where he finally found someone who gets it, right? Who understands that there is this other layer of meaning in the world behind what's visual, what's present, what's right there in front of you. This mythical world, the mythical world of a child. And like, when I read this, man, I was like, this is so awesome, man. I'm totally a puer, right? This is like, you know, don't pet the duck when it makes a poop, right? Divorced parents shouldn't lock their giant baby in a suitcase. Ménage à trois are morally ambiguous. Beware of the invisible bear. I actually got kicked out of Best Buy for taking this picture. I can't help but take my finger and put it like this in front of the lens of a camera when I see a duck, because it kind of looks gross. I've instructed my audience to dress up their vacuum cleaners, and they've done a great job. This was taken by the person who rode on the plane with me, who I didn't know, from New York to Spain. It was a long, long flight. In a sense, this is the way that I viewed the world, with a hat. The slide reads, "Reality, worst game ever." Right? It's sort of a challenge to layer meaning on top of the world in order to make it bearable. Oh. This is another quote that Marie-Louise Franz has about the puer and the puer's view on the world. When he has to take something seriously, either in the outer or inner world, he makes a few poor attempts and then impatiently gives up. Yes. Awesome. Once I tried to animate every letter in the alphabet, right? And it was actually really, really awesome until I got to around, like, D, right around here. And eventually I only got up to I. I won't bore you with it. But I now call tasks where you have to repeat the same thing more than 10 times alphabet tasks. And I avoid them at all costs. When I started to think about making games, this was the first game I made. It was called Every Second Counts. And all you do, it's spinning, is you click this button and try to hold it for incrementally longer periods of time. That's 0.2 seconds, this is 0.4 seconds, 0.6 seconds, and it goes on like that. Now, before the game was hacked, somebody had set a record of playing it for something like a minute and a half, which in total gameplay is like 15 minutes of gameplay. And then it was hacked, and all of a sudden the high scores went up to like an hour, 2 hours, right? It was absolutely incredible. And this guy who had hacked the system wrote me, and he was like, "You idiot, I wrote a C shell that just plays the game for me." And I was like, "You idiot, you wrote a C shell that played this game for you. That's absolutely bizarre." The second attempt that I made to build a game was actually serious in the way that Marie-Louise Franz was talking about. I wanted to take it seriously. I built a full level builder, collision detection, the works. I had it all set up to start actually building the levels, and I ended up making this. It's called Atheist. And then I felt bad for doing all that work, and I just repurposed it and made Buddhist, which looks exactly the same, except you come back as a duck. And then I made a third called Christian, same environment. There's two elevators. What do you want? Up or down? Down! That is so rarely chosen. Yeah, Commonwealth Club. That's the game. I got this note. I just have to include this slide. And I don't want to comment on it at all. It just says, "I played your atheist game. I don't get it. How do you win?" So, but the interesting thing is, you know, as I started reading this and started affiliating myself with this term of the eternal child, the thing sort of turned in the middle of my reading, which made it even more sort of painful. You can't see it on the size that I shrunk that cover down to, but it is the psychological study of the adult struggle with the paradise of childhood. All right, and this one, she goes even further. It's just the problem. She ditches the struggle, and it's now just the problem of the puer aeternus. It turns out that Jung thought of this as neurosis, which is kind of the damning word. So I had a neurosis. So what? Right? Who cares? This is sort of why I cared, is that these things resonate with me. A fear of being pinned down, caught in a situation from which it will be impossible to slip out again. Every just-so situation is hell. The feeling of a provisional life. The feeling that one is not yet in real life. That life is not yet what is really wanted. And that there is always a fantasy that sometime in the future the real thing will come about. Is there any resonance here? Right. There's usually like, you know, a few people that are like, "Oh crap." and it's an incredibly powerful thing, because this is, you know, for me anyways, this is a big, big part of my experience of the world. And reading this text, was transformative to some degree, because I'd kind of found home. And I kind of want to hang out with all the puers, like on an island somewhere, and we can all just pretend that nothing really is bad. And it would be great. So when Jung was asked, "What is the cure for the puer aeternus?" he said, "Work." And then he paused and he said, "Wait, can that really be it?" Yes, work. Right? For a moment, there were a lot of people holding their breath, being like, "Please be lollipops, please be lollipops." But no, it was work. So the question is what does that mean in this context, right? This context that I'm starting to try to like build here, which is, personally, like in a personal struggle, to struggle against these wonderful things. And the word neurosis should not throw us off from the magic and hopefulness and incredible sensations of youth, right? But, what is work in this context? And I think about this. I think, oh, are you kidding me? We have 10 minutes? Holy wow. All right, so Martin Seligman, The Pleasant Life, The Good Life, Meaningful Life. So I think about this, right? Martin Seligman, he's the founder maybe of positive psychology, and he thinks about the pleasant life, the good life, and the meaningful life. Eudaimonia being the good life and meaningful life coming out of that. And so these are three kinds of categories. And what I think is that the drivers of the web right now, the web culture overall, are optimized towards the pleasant life. They're optimized that way because things that are popular are kind of optimized around the parts of us that want to make things popular. And those parts of us are the puer parts. They're the parts that are obsessive about the way that we look to the rest of the world. They're obsessive about sex, about lust. They're kind of like, think about that crack period of your life when you were an adolescent to a teen where it really meant something if your friends decided not to take you to a party. Right? It was the worst thing in the world, right? Or that girl or that guy that you had a crush on, man, it just like was absolutely the thing. And so these tendencies, the churning of the popular culture, like the focus on virality, on popularity, is all driven by this very, very specific kind of driver, which optimizes towards the pleasant, the pleasurable, this kind of momentary thing. And the question, this is what I would call the world of Facebook, right? Where there's this moment in the movie where he's like, oh, dude, people want to know whether you're single or not. That's puer, right? Just raising its head. The like button, right? Condensing all of our tastes down to this gesture that we did a million times when we passed notes around. This, the puer in game form, the eternal child who waters crops that wither and then you can bring back to life, right? This is immortality encoded. When you pitch an angel round right now, right? You're in there and you're like, yeah, I'm trying to raise money for this. Inevitably, the question comes back, will it help people get laid, right? And I say, yes, of course it will, right? It's Nietzsche and Darwin smushed together. That which does not kill us helps us get laid. It's necessary. This is all Dionysus, man. When we connected the globe, what we did is unleashed the beast again, right? Dionysus is back and he's playing hard, right? When we're all sort of connected in this way, that's kind of these forces come up and they rear their heads, and it's not a bad thing. It's an exciting, wild, wonderful thing. But if we want to have meaningful, connective experiences, there's something else. I don't think that algorithms necessarily are going to save us in this way. There's work to do. There's actual work that needs to be done to try to take some of the more difficult adult-like emotions of fear and being sorry and all these things and put them into those spaces. I know a lot of people who, when they want to say something really meaningful, will never text. They will never write a Facebook message. They say, well, I need to do it in person. Well, a lot of our relationships don't allow that anymore. It's just the facts, right? It's gotten bigger. And I would say that the challenge that we have is to make it a practice of trying to understand how we can exercise those kinds of emotions in the virtual space. And I think, I say that work is play on this slide. And the reason is that Martin Seligman, for example, not that he plays at this stuff, but he has set up a lab to try to understand how you can make people happier. And it's amazing. They do it just like people study drugs, mixology of chemicals and compounds. And they try lots of different things out and try to optimize towards experiences. One is this, the gratitude visit, where you write down on a piece of paper something that you're thankful for, and you fly. You fly to them, and you go to their door, and you read it to them. You read to them why you're grateful. And he said that months later, there is a noticeable, measurable difference in their happiness and their level of depression, right? Jane McGonigal also, in her book, Reality is Broken, really talks about how, you know, you can start thinking about gestures in play to make positive impacts on psychology. And I'm sort of blown away. So the question is how, what does this work look like for us, right? And some people do it naturally. Right? It's making a discipline out of it that interests me. But I have this toy called the flower maker, where you make stupid little flowers, wonderful little flowers, however you want to say it. Most people call them names like fleur or springtime or violet. But there was a little moment last year, and about 10,000 people use this every day. Somebody emailed me and said, go look at your site right now. These were the names of the flowers. Laid off work today. Sorry for layoff. Moved for this job. Hard to start over again. Well, try to hope. Thanks. Sorry, complain. So sorry to hear it. A very sucky economy. Like, this is a super, super simple gesture, but the notion of taking this risk of communicating in these spaces about things that are difficult, to me, is absolutely inspirational. So for the last number of years, this is what I've tried to do, is to think about what are the small gestural ways that we can kind of start to, or that I can start to think about what it means to go into these spaces and have some kind of like meaningful moments. How can, you know, that come about? This is something called Just Say It. It's very, very simple. All it is a place to send anonymous love letters. Highly, highly moderated. At this point, there's been about 5,000 sent. And they're absolutely wonderful to go through. As an audience member, you can go there. It is a Libya subdomain, so it was a little weird, and it still is right now. This is a company that I formed a little while ago called Star.me. And the only gesture on the site is to give stars to other people, to appreciate them in different ways. The Call Me Star, different kinds of stars. There's the I'm Sorry Star, the Thank You Star. You guys can all check it out, by the way. I made a special passcode called Commonwealth, if you're interested, later on tonight. But it's an incredibly simple gestures, and I'm going to sort of breeze through it. But I will say that there was this moment that I love about this project so far, where this young woman, a teenager, emailed the tech support and said, please, I need to unlock some apology stars right now. And I said, how many? And she said, a lot. This was a project called, actually, let's skip through because we don't have very much time. And unfortunately, I have so many slides. Are you coming up here to throw me away? Don't do the gavel, because I think if you hit the gavel three times, I have to stop.
No, I don't.
And if you don't do it, I think the next census, I'm technically counted as still being here.
You're good.
There was a point where, I'll close with this, but these are the sorts of projects that I've been involved with, where this woman told me that she had an incredible amount of anxiety in her life. She had just moved somewhere. She had just started a new job. And she asked me if I could do a song for her, because at that time I'd been doing these kinds of songs. So I asked her to describe very specifically what it felt like when she was feeling these emotions. And she wrote a very good boilerplate for me. I love I Want to Punch All of You in the Neck. I think that completely focuses things. But it ends with, can I have a hug? So what I did is I sent, when people would email me randomly, I said, hey, can you record your own voice? And I sent them a little backing track.
Hey.
And said, can you sing along to this? And so I would get these voices back. And now I have 5 minutes.
Hey. You're okay.
I'll calm down. So I would get these voices back, right? And so that's one person trying to sing along to this track that I created for this woman, right? And if you just heard it, it's raw, right? It's rough. And that was one of the better ones. There were these incredible tracks that were sent by, like, you know, guys who had a baritone and were singing bass. Okay. And it was crazy because, like, I got these in and I was like, there's no way this is going to work. This is going to just be terrible. But they started coming in. And all of a sudden, I had 30, I had 40, and suddenly I had this chorus from around the world. And they were all singing a song to this one person to cure her anxiety, right? And so I'll play you the final track, and I think we'll probably end it there because I don't want to go beyond that too much. Maybe I'll say one other thing. Wait, one more thing. there was this, she sent me this note originally, and, you know, I was like, yeah, absolutely. I'll see if I can come up with something. And, you know, some time passed, a month and a half at least, where I was interacting with all these people, and she sent me another note where it was like, thank you so much for even considering doing the project. That even means something to me. I understand if you're too busy. Thanks. right? And it was like 2 days away from completion, so I didn't even email her back. So it was like a surprise party, right? She felt really crappy and then, you know, really, really good. Sort of like my experience here, you know? I thought there was going to be no party, and now I'm like so happy. So this is the song that I emailed her that 2 days later. And if we can get a little longer.
Right now it feels like I forgot to turn the light on. And things that looked so good yesterday are now shades of gray. And it seems like the world is spinning while I'm standing still. Oh, maybe I am spinning, I can't tell. And then you say,
an 11-year-old girl.
You're okay. You'll be fine. Just free.
And now the women sing,
hey, you're okay. You'll be fine.
You'll be fine.
Just free.
Now everybody sings,
hey. You're okay, you'll be fine, just breathe. Hey, you're okay, you'll be fine, just breathe.
So the challenge, I guess, that I leave all of you is, what is your work? What are the virtual experiences or the platforms or the places where you haven't tried to express the kinds of gratitude, sorrow, apologies, whatever, and that you could play in? Thank you.
Well, that was great. That was great. I'd like to invite our audience to step up to the mic, and while they're queuing up with their questions, I have a thing to share with you about obsessive lust and longing on Facebook. One of the most emotional experiences I had in the past year was when I deleted somebody from my friends. I don't know how many of you have had this experience. I just thought I would clean up my audience and delete some people. I didn't want to see, you know, certain things, family photos and so forth, as opposed to just creating different groups. And I realized I made a terrible mistake, and I wanted that friend back. I wanted that friend back, and never forgave me. I couldn't apologize enough. I should have just said, oh, I didn't do it, Facebook did it. But I was very honest.
That's good, yes. Yeah. You should have lied.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And then your friendship would be very strong.
Yeah.
Even today.
But what I found that was so odd is that, you know, it's such a, I mean, we have a friendship in real life. Why did Facebook matter so much? And
Well, you know, what's interesting about that is I actually, so I did a talk for the National Association for Funeral Directors. At one point, and it was an interesting talk, I have to say. What was even more interesting was the trade show floor, where I was introduced to lots of things that I didn't know existed. For example, oil paints that you could mix crematory ashes into, and USB drives that could also hold crematory ashes. Crematory ashes turned out to be a very, very big marketing pitch there. And there were even demos, which that really creeped me out because I don't think anyone would want to end up that way. But the interesting thing was that there were so in preparation for the talk, I asked people, you know, what has your experience been with death in virtual spaces, death online? Mm-hmm. And it's an area that's incredibly underserved. You know, there's a lot of there. It is. I mean, here's an example. You know, my 14-year-old son died, and I know he plays World of Warcraft all the time and has friends there. How do I tell them? What do I say? You know, how do I get the password to that account? How do I reach out to these people that I know really mattered in his life? There's even small gestural things that take a lot of, like, effort to understand. these are all emails that actually came in. One of my students died, and his name keeps coming up in the autofill on my email account. Mm. I don't feel okay deleting it. The interesting thing is that the role of the undertaker, I mean, if we think about the transition to the virtual space, right, the role of the undertaker, this has been a very deep, deep ceremonial position. The notion of the processional is metaphorical as well. It's the transition internally, both externally, from life to death, and the notion of moving on. And in virtual spaces, there is as much need for those kinds of actions as anywhere else. And it takes work to address that stuff. And it was really remarkable to me. I mean, I definitely understand what you said about accidentally deleting something. That is potentially incredibly dramatic.
Yeah, it's a grieving process for sure. Well, let's take our first question.
You grieved? Oh, because of the Facebook friend thing?
Yeah. Like, I mean, wouldn't take me back as a Facebook friend.
Right. Yes. I understand, yeah.
Yes, first question, please.
Dude, you're totally going to make me cry. I was a huge fan of the show on your website, safefrank.com. And during its popularity and heyday, you got wooed by Hollywood. And I'm sorry if this is a little off topic, but I know you flew out there. You had some meetings. I was just wondering what you learned from it, what you could incorporate from your own life, and what was the whole process like having meetings with Hollywood?
Well, it was otherworldly in the truest sense. I mean, it is the most remarkable engine in that it produces fantasies, and you know, if you get a peek backstage at the mechanics of how these incredible, incredible works of art and parts of culture get made, it's a little distressing, to be quite honest with you. And I drank a lot of those little waters that they give you at meetings. That was another big part of it. I ended up getting something called a blind script deal, so I got to do the entirety of the process. I wrote a movie with a wonderful writer called Erica Rivenoia. And that movie, I believe, is somewhere on a second-level basement in a Universal Studios lot. I'm very, very proud of that. In fact, it's one of my accolades. But, you know, during that time, I stayed, you know, one foot squarely online. And, you know, I found I don't know what it would have been like had they really wanted me. I will preface it with that. But since they didn't, I hated them. I didn't want to be there at all. I found it, you know, really, really interesting. There's a lot of waiting around that happens almost always, but it's very, very hard for me to be dismissive of it all, because such incredible things get made there. And even at the worst times, even when I felt the worst about meetings or deals falling through or things like that, that definitely stayed in my mind. I don't know if that was sort of a rambling answer.
No, that was great. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Well, first I wanted to say thank you very much, Zay Frank, for just putting yourself out there. It can't be easy, and I think you've definitely made a lot of connections. I know that I felt a connection through your work online. What I'd like to ask for you is some help. My problem with Facebook is I'm the guy that needs the dislike button. I'm the guy that doesn't know how to respond to my kind of extremist friends that post stuff on their Facebooks. And these are people I care about. These are relatives. And I don't know what to do. And so sometimes I will make the acerbic comment or get carried away and have, like, you know, a mile-long post in response to, you know, what I view as, like, attacks and misinformation that I must correct. So, but these are people also that if I'm in the real world staring at them in the face, I love these people, and I want to respond, and I kind of think I have to respond, though, when they say stuff like that. But I kind of end up probably being a little rude, and I don't know what's the kind of compassionate response, or what's the best way to respond to that, to kind of let them know, hey, I think that maybe you're being a little extreme here.
I would start with the last sentence that you just spoke. I think that was very, very well said. I don't know the answer to those sorts of questions. I think that
it's certainly something that I've struggled with, but I think that it is, again, a space that you're going to have to play with a little bit. And I think that, you know, doing things like reducing it to simple language, drawing boundaries, and then understanding that, you know, you're going to have to give over a little bit to the unknown. You're going to have to try stuff out that resonates with you personally, and where you draw boundaries and you make them clear, and you're going to have to give over to the fact that they might not respond well at all. And it's just sort of like a part of that whole communication process. You know, my response would probably be to take their words and make them into a song, or try to make tie-dye T-shirts with some of their slogans, with like a beautiful bird in the middle that, you know, said Obama on it or something like that. Maybe they're liberal extremists, in which case I don't have much experience on this. But
thank you.
Yeah, cheers. Good luck with that.
Well, let's take a question from this side.
Hi. I have a question that sort of combines the themes of what you were talking about children and childhood, or eternal children, and social media. We've seen a lot of problems with children or teenagers using media and a lot of the cruelty. So I was wondering if you could speak to how you can teach children or teenagers how to behave appropriately on the web, and the impact, the social, emotional impact of what they do. And what do you think is the appropriate age that children can handle that?
I mean, first off, I should say that I'm wholly unqualified to answer that question. That said, four is the age that one begins with this particular process. And one must be stern, but gentle. It's interesting. I think first of all, that leading by example is obviously a big part of it. I think that platforms and destinations that are massive communication tools for kids that have no real shepherding in the ways of, you know, what's right and what's wrong, can very quickly get out of hand. And, you know, anyone that's sort of seen the stream of YouTube comments, I feel like raising a child in that environment, there would be a part of me that would be like, oh man, like the world's not like that really, but it is now, right? And it is a sort of training ground for a certain kind of reactivity, and sort of training yourself to understand how to make impact in shadowy worlds of anonymity. That, you know, but on the other hand, I know that there are groups of YouTubers, for example, that have made such incredible efforts and made such they've done a lot of work in trying to cultivate a certain kind of atmosphere. And I think of the Vlog Brothers and something called the Harry Potter Alliance, which is 100,000 younger people strong. And they were responsible for 4 cargo planes going to Haiti with relief, all based on donations that very young people were doing. And so, I think in the case of the Vlog Brothers, it's this phrase, don't forget to be awesome, that sort of rallies people together. And you have two very, very smart creators that have made an ethical stance. But I think that is ultimately what is needed, is people to take the challenge of ethics. I mean, this is now a little side point, but, you know, popularity and virality and growth are non-ethical structures. They're not unethical. They're just non-ethical. Like, ethics need to be inserted into those spaces, and they have to be inserted forcefully. Like, you have to have the will to do it. So if you have a culture where, you know, the main rewards go to people that capture the mechanics of virality and popularity, you're going to run into this problem again and again. And this is sort of what I mean by the work of it. There has to be like a culture of people that are making the active choice to potentially curtail their audience size to have, you know, the kinds of messages that I think you're talking about. So 4 was the answer.
Okay, next question, please.
Hi. What do you think about people communicating online with like things like image macros or things like that? And I find myself a lot of times responding to an email with a YouTube video, or I'll make a little GIF or something like that. Do you think that it will evolve into just like Hallmark cards, pre-canned communications. And then maybe in addition to that, are you excited at, like, you seem to be really into, are you excited at how compelling online communication can be when you do make a piece of custom creative content for someone and that ongoing, I guess. And more people, like in 5 years, people are communicating through song, custom for a person, or things like that.
Can you do that again?
Yes.
But sort of crystallize it a little bit for me. Is it the customization, the idea that like customized media
It's the two sides of it, of like people using pre-canned things versus creating something of their own, because there's this great opportunity to communicate more densely with an image or a video or a piece of audio online rather than just talking to someone. So there's the pre-canned Hallmark card side. I took this image macro and I'm going to respond to you with it, and it might not be perfect, versus creating something custom for
like
that
using
person.
A sticker.
Oh, yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, well, I think there's places for both. I mean, I think that, you know, the success of Hallmark was that they made difficult things easy to say. And in a way, that's what, you know, Startup Me is also about. And I think, you know, that's why we send things like that sometimes. But I think it's a blend. I mean, I think that, you know, my guess is that that sort of communication definitely increases. I don't know whether it replaces. I mean, just the frequency by which we communicate is just going through the roof. So I don't know, like, where the interference pattern is exactly there.
I forgot how to ask a question in a non-money way because I communicate through images. Right?
But there's a YouTube video that you could have pointed me to that, that you've already pre-recorded with that question.
There you go. We'll cut to that on the video.
I think that, yes, I don't know what to say exactly to that, but it's super interesting. I mean, I find myself doing it as well, and I think about emoji, for example, in text messaging, which in some parts of the world has completely overwhelmed regular text messaging. And I find myself, emoji, by the way, are like emoticons, but taken to the nth power. So there's every kind of little tiny 20 by 20 graphic out there, from flowers to trains to very awful things. And, you know, I find myself sending these things off, and they're, even when I send them, they're nonsensical. But here we're getting back to the power of the exclamation, right? When they're on the receiving end, you know, they might be incredibly meaningful. I don't know. This is that problem that kind of emerges in the virtual world. And in fact, Duchamp started, and all the sort of post-structuralists were talking about in the 50s, which is like, oh, wow, like the viewer actually unpacks this information, and the viewer is part of the conversation. And it's, yes, it's possible that we could get to a point where we're all kind of glued in chairs and sending each other completely random messages generated, you know, by some script, and we're all living very, very meaningful, rich lives based purely on a Skinnerian principle. And that was like the most ridiculous answer to a question that I've ever given in my entire life.
Amazing.
And I would like to say Newtonian physics.
All right, well, we're running short on time, so we have two more questions from the mic. Well, let's do a minute apiece.
Sure. So the question is, you obviously are very fond of the idea of play online, but how do we play in a world where everyone's watching online too and watching you?
That was very creepy. I like it. I mean, I like it because it adds drama. I don't see any conflict in that. I mean, most, you know, play revolves around having some sort of an audience. In fact, play gets heightened in a lot of cases with the role of a spectator. So are you talking about, like, you specifically watching me? Because that would inhibit me a little bit.
No, more in the sense of, look, Facebook is connecting everything and everyone.
Yeah.
And say, let's say, this good sir used to be a really strong World of Warcraft player of some sort. I don't know what sort he would be. But now, with him being on Facebook Connect, all of his friends, everyone in this room, because he has, say, 95, also now know he is a World of Warcraft player.
Right.
Before, he could escape. Now,
I feel like we should go on a hike together. Because I sense that there's like a kernel of meaning that I'm not getting, but that's important to you, obviously. That has to do with, you know, I guess the idea that we have around play versus, you know, the hidden intrusion of other people having other kinds of hidden knowledge.
You can't escape on the web anymore.
It's true.
And we live in public. And I think that's the basis for this whole conversation. We live to serve an audience. It's an audience that we create and invite into our world, especially when it's Facebook. And it creates the better me, right? The me that we aspire to. That's we almost have like have an avatar of ourselves living in this virtual world. We're losing our sense of the physical space as we give more to the virtual space.
I play in public. I play because I actually want a lot of people to watch. And it hasn't really interfered with my play all that much. So I don't know. Maybe that's a starting point.
Thank you. That's great. So I'm going to take your question. No? Let's take your question. Let's do it quickly because Inforum gets the last question. So right. Go ahead.
So my question is pretty simple and selfish. I really enjoyed when you had the show for about a year. And I really look forward to, you know, watching every day what you came up with. Very creative, like how you can come up with one of those things every single day. And I struggle with that in my daily life, trying to be creative every day. Are you planning on doing something like that in the near future?
Like the show?
Yeah, it doesn't have to be the same, but, you know, like how do you stay creative every day and, like, you know, keep it going?
How do I say great? I think you just make the choice. It's not something that, you know, grows on your foot. It's, you know, something where you get up every day and sometimes you're feeling non-creative and you just make something. And I think that's really the key. I don't have any particular plans to do a daily show in the style of the show right now, and I think that's smart of me. You should come to Start At Me, and there'll be lots of little weird surprises. This is also the fifth year anniversary of the show, and I'm replaying the whole thing with commentary. But in terms of coming up with ideas, it's, you know, a great place to start, read Twyla Tharp's On the Creative Habit. Read Anne Lamott's Bird by Bird. You know, like, read artists, psychologists, read, you know, Mihai Csikszentmihalyi. Read, like, just start getting into the discipline of reading and practicing, and I'm sure you already do, obviously. But that's super inspired me. Just looking at the breadth of ideas that people use to inspire themselves, it's hard. It's hard. I mean, this pain, it's so counterintuitive when you look at people who are, you know, high producers and of incredible, wonderful, wonderful things. And you look behind the scenes, and they're just a ball of pain because it's just hard. But thank you.
Well, thank you, Zay Frank. So the Inforum gets the last question. And instead of what's your 60-second idea to change the world, what's your 6-second idea to change the world? Because I'm getting the hook.
Diet lemonade that has a $20 bill in it.
Awesome.
For more countries. I'm gonna just blurt something out, which is I think I would love to see a discipline around specifically many-to-one design, where the idea is solving individual people's problems. There's a dream project I have called Code for Joy, which is an open-source coder project where you take one kid with a disability somewhere who may not have the use of arms or language or things like that, and you have a lot of people trying to come up with toys that are make that kid feel like they're creative, like they're special, like they can do amazing things. So that's my sort of wish.
Oh, that's beautiful. Well, let's give a round of applause for Zay Frank. This has been fantastic. Thank you so much. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club in Forum, Connect Your Intellect, is adjourned.
Awesome.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was